come on, you hobby.
It's when I take them out.
Oh, come on. I saw it was 34.
I don't know why this isn't working. Well, anyway. I guess we're going to have to go with one screen today. We were talking about sugars in preparation for talking about polysaccharides. We're looking at monosaccharides. And I think I mentioned last time that any given monosaccharide can exist in either of two forms, and it oscillates back and forth between these forms if it's on its own, if it's an isolated monosaccharide. And so you can go back and forth between the so-called linear form, which we're seeing on the left here, or the ringed form. And like I say, if it's just a monosaccharide, you can find it in either of two states at any given moment. But notice that when the ring form is formed, the thing has to wrap back around on itself and form another covalent bond. And in so doing, it loses the double bond of the carbonyl group. So the ring structure does not have a carbonyl, whereas the linear one does. In slide 22, we can see that because of chirality, there is not only a right-handed and left-handed version of monosaccharides, like glucose here, for instance. This is the D form of glucose, which is the right-handed version. But there's even two types of right-handed versions, depending on the position of this hydroxyl that's shaded. So when it's downward facing, that's the alpha version, upward facing in this picture. It's the beta version. And seems like a small difference, but that makes a difference as to how these things get joined together when you make a polysaccharide. And that's why you can have different polysaccharides that are all pure glucose, but are different from each other because of what version of glucose they use. Well, in 23, we're starting to put these things together. So what we have here are not monosaccharides. These happen to be disaccharides because they're made by two monosaccharides exactly hooked together. But the major point here is really not the size of it. It's the fact that when you hook monosaccharides together to make a bigger sugar, what you do is form a covalent bond called a glycosidic linkage or a glycosidic bond. And notice that this can happen in different ways depending on what kind of monosaccharide you use. So, for instance, any given disaccharide is going to be two monosaccharides, but you could use the same monosaccharide twice. You could use two different monosaccharides. So that's part of the variety. Maltose is simply two alpha glucoses hooked together by a glycosidic linkage. Lactose, which is milk sugar, hence the name, is a galactose and a glucose. Sucrose, or table sugar, is a glucose and a fructose. But notice it's a beta fructose and an alpha glucose. In any case, it's a glycosidic bond that holds together two monosaccharides. But there are, notice, several different hydroxyls hanging off of the ringed form of a monosaccharide. And therefore, there is not just one connection point for hooking two monosaccharides together. It's not like proteins and nucleic acids in other words, which can be put together only in one way. Right? In a protein, you have to hook the amino end of one amino acid to the carboxyl end of the next amino acid. It's the only way. That's why they don't branch. Well, you have multiple choices here on a monosaccharide, and that's why polysaccharides can be branched. They could be linear entirely, or they could be linear for a while and then branch because there's more than one possible hooking point for making these glycosidic bonds. Also importantly, if you're making a polysaccharide, it has to be the ringed version of the monosaccharides. The linear forms you can't hook together to make a polysaccharide. They have to be in the ringed configuration to make these glycosidic bonds. So those are all disaccharides. They're not officially polysaccharides simply because they're not big enough, but you can make bigger ones by just continuing the process of making more glycosidic bonds. As we see in 24, we've talked about these particular examples before. You have starch in A, glycogen in B. Starch is made by plants, glycogen by us animals, but they both have the same function. What is their function?
Storage.
They are examples of storage polysaccharides because the purpose of building them is simply to store this extra fuel, which are the glucose monomers that they're made of, in a more compact form. The intention later on is to dismantle this thing so that you have individual glucoses that you use as fuel in the cell. So these glycogen and starch aren't made for structural reasons, right? That's why they're not structural polysaccharides. They're both made entirely out of glucose monomers, many, many glucose monomers. The major difference is that the animal version is much more highly branched than the plant version, starch. Glycogen is much more branched than starch. And the more branches you put into it, the more quickly it can be dismantled, which is more important in an animal, right? Animals need energy a lot more quickly in certain times than a plant does. So plant starch is not as highly branched, but you see that it is branched. Well, 24 is a cartoon of cellulose, which is the main structural polysaccharide that we find in nature. Once again, you're hooking nothing but glucoses together, but in this case, it's not for the storage of the energy, it's for production of some structural element. All right. Now, starch and glycogen that we just looked at, those are made with alpha versions of glucose. They're alpha glucose monomers that are hooked together to form glycogen and starch. Here we're using beta glucose. And so just that alternative position of that hydroxyl makes a big difference on how these things get bonded together and how stable they are structurally once they're done. All right, so by hooking together a bunch of beta glucoses end-to-end with so-called beta 1-4 linkages, that just refers to the fact that this carbon number 1 is the connection point for this next one's carbon number 4, using betas in both cases. When you do that over and over, you form a long strand, and then a bunch of those strands bundled together in parallel makes for a very strong structural element like this microfiber that's being shown here. 26. So we have polysaccharide units other than just standard monosaccharides as well. That's what we're looking at the top here. These ones aren't standard monosaccharides because they aren't just carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, notice. These have an amino group in them somewhere. But many organisms use these aminated monosaccharides as monomers or subunits for building bigger polysaccharides. Like you can see right here, if you have a repeating structure of these acetylglucosamines and acetylmuramic acid, then you have the makings of a bacterial cell wall. Just an example of another structural polysaccharide. Animals make chitin. This is the principal component of insects' exoskeletons. It's what makes for that hardness of the insect shell. Another example of a structural polysaccharide. But all of those have nitrogen in them, which helps. Okay. 27. Now we're into lipids. And lipids have certain things in common, no matter what kind of lipid you're talking about, which is that they are hydrophobic for the most part. And that's because lipids are largely hydrocarbon when it comes down to the actual atomic arrangement in the molecule. There's a lot of carbons and hydrogens. Therefore, they are nonpolar, and therefore they are hydrophobic. On top, though, we see fatty acids, which are small lipids that you can see by their schematic representation are almost entirely hydrocarbon, right? The squiggle is just shorthand in organic chemistry, right? You don't want to bother to write all the carbons and hydrogens in an organic compound because there are so many. So whenever you have a corner that represents a carbon, then you just have to imagine however many hydrogens connected to it in order to fulfill its valence. But at the very end, you have of any given fatty acid, of which there are different kinds, you have a COOH. And what functional group is that? It's a carboxyl group, which makes fatty acids carboxylic acids. Anything that has a carboxyl group is called a carboxylic acid. That's why acid is in the name of fatty acid. Fatty acids by themselves are excellent energy stores simply because they're chock full of these carbon-hydrogen bonds, which because of the equal sharing, for reasons we'll discuss later, means that there's a lot of potential energy that can be extracted from them. So they are the most efficient way of storing energy in the body, meaning they have the greatest energy density. That means for a given gram of lipids, you can store a lot more energy as a gram of lipids than you can store as a gram of protein, for instance, or of polysaccharide. That's why when we take in more energy than we need in our food, we don't waste that. There's been selective pressure over evolutionary history to save that extra energy because for the bulk of our history, food has been in shortage. So you store that extra energy as efficiently as possible by storing it in the form of an energy-dense nutrient, which are fats, full of fatty acids. If we stored our extra energy as protein or as carbohydrate, and we do a little bit of carbohydrate, of course, but if we stored it as either one of those, we would have to weigh more than we do now for storing that same amount of energy. And that would be more costly for us to move around, and therefore we would be wasting energy. Fatty acids, though, when they are performing the function of just temporarily storing that energy, are usually complexed with a glycerol, which is what kind of molecule? What does the name glycerol tell you that it is? It's an alcohol. It's a triple alcohol, really, right? There's three hydroxyls. Well, those hydroxyls on the glycerol are potential binding sites, right? Remember, when you do a condensation reaction, something has a hydrogen hanging off of it, something has an OH hanging off of it. So these are connection points for fatty acids. A fat and a fatty acid are not the same. A fatty acid is one component of a fat. And by the way, fat and lipid shouldn't be used interchangeably. Fats are just one kind of lipid. All these things on this screen are lipids, but they're not all fats. Yeah.
So people say fatty acid is actually connected to another structure.
Right. A fat is also called a tricarboxylic acid or a triglyceride. Okay, they all mean the same thing. Triglyceride has that glyce root in it because glycerol is what holds the fat together. It has these three connection points. If you take three individual fatty acids and undergo a condensation reaction with glycerol to form an overall fat, that's the complete molecule, the fat. Right, that stores energy. That's one function of fat. It's not the only function. But to get that energy out of it, you're going to dismantle that back down into glycerol and fatty acids, each of which can actually serve as fuel. They're processed differently in the cell, but glycerol itself holds energy as well in fuel terms. That's just one function of a fat, though. What else does fat do for us?
Insulation.
Thermal insulation, exactly. It minimizes the exchange of heat between you and the surroundings. Whether it's an inward flow of heat or an outward flow of heat is determined by the gradient. But in either case, fat has high thermal resistance, so it minimizes that exchange. And another important function? It forms padding in places in the body. So without the fat, there would be more likelihood of damage to underlying tissues. A layer of fat will protect that organ, whatever it is, from trauma. Okay, so there are, that's what a fat is, or a triacyl glycerol, or a triglyceride. What, did I say tricarboxylic acid?
Yeah.
Why didn't anyone correct me? The three names for a fat are fat, triacyl glycerol, or triglyceride. Those all are completely interchangeable. They mean exactly the same thing. But fatty acid is just a component of that. In C, we're looking at phospholipids, and there are many kinds of phospholipids. So when you think about a plasma membrane, it's not made of just the same exact phospholipid over and over. There are different kinds. And they are similar in a lot of cases, or many of them, are very similar to a fat. In other words, some of them, a lot of them actually, most of them have glycerol as a component as well. And just like glycerol in making a fat has three connection points. But in the case of glycerol in a phospholipid, only two of those are made, the connection is made with fatty acids. That's why a phospholipid has two fatty acid tails, not three. A fat has three. The third connection point is made with whatever makes that overall phospholipid partly polar at that end. That's why a fat is nonpolar, but a phospholipid is polar on one end and nonpolar where the tails are. But still, there's three connection points on the glycerol. Well, there are phosphoglycerides, one type of phospholipid. There are also sphingolipids, which use sphingosine as a, which is what's shaded there, instead of glycerol as the basis. But any given plasma membrane is a mixture of different kinds of phospholipids. In fact, these two names, phosphoglyceride and sphingolipid, are just categories themselves. There are specific examples of each of those. When you get down to the bottom, you can see glycolipids also use sphingosine as a base, but connect carbohydrates to that. Glycolipids are also important for integrity of membranes, but because of what does the glyco part mean? Means sugar. Glyc means sugar. So a glycolipid is a lipid with a carbohydrate stuck to it, covalently. So the overall thing is a glycolipid. The lipid part is what keeps it in the membrane, but the glyco part, the sugar component that sticks outwardly, is usually used more or less as an ID tag. This is the way cell-to-cell recognition works. A carbohydrate little flag with a specific shape says, I am this type of cell. It's one use of it. It can also be used to connect two cells together in forming a tissue, keep it helping them stay together. So those are glycolipids. We have steroids, which are lipids. Steroids include cholesterol, but also all of the derivatives of cholesterol. So animals make cholesterol, and then out of that cholesterol, they make all of their steroid hormones, right? All of the estrogens, testosterone, glucocorticoids, they're all modified cholesterol. Cholesterol is the starting point, basically. And so they all have, anything that is made from cholesterol will still have this four-ring structure, easy to recognize schematically. That's us animals. What did I say are sterols that plants make called? What's the combining form, meaning plant? Phyto, P-H-Y-T-O. So phytosterols are similar substances, lipids made by plants. Plants don't make cholesterol, which is why a pure plant diet won't get you any additional cholesterol, but of course you're going to have cholesterol because you are an animal. We cannot live without cholesterol. It's also an important component of our membranes, by the way, as phytosterols are in plants. But obviously you can't live without it because you need to make all these other things from it, these steroid hormones. And then terpenes are things that are made mostly by plants. Terpenes are based on isoprene subunits, and you can see one isoprene right here. There can be a wide variety of how many isoprenes get repeated over and over, but an isoprene by itself, notice, is a hydrocarbon. It's purely hydrocarbon. Other things can be stuck onto it to make a terpene, but there will be one or more isoprenes in that terpene. Certain insects make these, but it's mostly a plant product. This is what essential oils are rich in. They usually have quite a strong odor, which is what the function is in some cases for plants, to keep them from being eaten by other things. They're important components in resins and things like that. So they're commercially valuable to us as well, but they're lipids. Okay, now to 28. We're looking at two different fatty acids here. Palmitate and oleate are just examples. It doesn't matter what they are. Those names aren't important. But there's two principal ways in which you can have variety in fatty acids. Any fatty acid is going to have a carboxyl at the end and then a hydrocarbon tail from there. But there are different kinds of fatty acids for two different reasons. What are the sources of variety?
Double bond.
Whether or not there is a double bond is one source. And that's the distinction between a saturated and an unsaturated fatty acid. Now, saturated means full of, right? What it means in this case is full of hydrogens. A hydrogen can form only one bond, right? Carbon's going to form four. Well, in a chain of a chain-like carbon skeleton, two of those bonds for any of the internal carbons will be made with other carbons, right? But each of those carbons has to make two more bonds to be satisfied. To include as many hydrogens as possible, that means it forms only single bonds. That way, each of those internal carbons can be bonded to two hydrogens. Therefore, the overall fatty acid has as many hydrogens as you can possibly fit on that skeleton. And that's why we call it saturated. On the other hand, if you form a double bond between two carbons in that skeleton, then it's using up one of those bonds to make that second part of the double bond. And therefore, you don't have as many hydrogens on that kind of fatty acid. And that's why they're called unsaturated. Now, this has important biological implications, specifically with respect to membranes. Fatty acids, recall, are components of fats, but they're also components of phospholipids. Any given phospholipid has these fatty acid tails. Well, if there are nothing but single bonds, in other words, if the fatty acids are saturated, then it forms an unbent hydrocarbon tail. Whereas if there is at least one double bond, then that double bond is going to, any given double bond is going to form a kink in this shape. It's going to bend. There can be different degrees of unsaturation, by the way. You can have a monounsaturated fatty acid, which is what oleate is, because there's only one double bond in it. So unsaturated is the general word. You can say monounsaturated if there's only one double bond, polyunsaturated if there are more than one double bond within that same fatty acid. And then we can also use the word saturated and unsaturated to refer to fats or to phospholipids. We can say that a fat or a phospholipid is either saturated or unsaturated. The only way that it's saturated is if every fatty acid that's a component of that bigger structure is itself saturated. Otherwise, it's an unsaturated fat or phospholipid. Well, back to this membrane story. If you think about these two shapes here, either unbent or bent, that's going to affect how they pack together, right? If you have a bunch of stiff wires, like coat hanger wire, a bunch of little pieces, not the whole hanger, just linear pieces. If you have nothing but unbent ones and you just throw them into a box, they're gonna not take up much space, right? They're going to pack together pretty nicely. Whereas if there's a bend in each one, and especially if the bend is in different positions for each one, and you put them into a box, they're not going to fit together nearly as nicely. Well, that's what happens with plasma membranes. Plasma membranes can be made up of, they're always made up of a mixture of phospholipids that are saturated and phospholipids that are unsaturated, but the more unsaturated phospholipids that are included in a plasma membrane, the more bent the tails are, in other words, the more fluid or loose the plasma membrane is because of that not packing together as tightly. And sometimes a cell wants to increase its membrane fluidity. For instance, when it gets cold, things start to gel up, right? And therefore, if you make it looser, it will maintain the proper fluidity for that conditions. On the other hand, if it gets really warm, things are going to loosen up just because of the temperature. You don't want them to loosen up too much, so you can take out the unsaturated fatty phospholipids and put in saturated ones to replace them. And now you have you maintain the proper membrane fluidity. Okay, 29 just shows you what I talked about before with respect to cholesterol. Each one of these looks very similar to the cholesterol molecule that you saw on a previous slide, but they're all different signals. These are all steroid hormones. Estradiol is the main estrogen in humans. Testosterone is the main androgen. So estrogens are feminizing hormones. Testosterone is a masculizing hormone. Androgens in general are. In that sense, they kind of have opposite effects, but notice that they are very, very similar to each other. The ring structure is really essentially unchanged in both. What is different in these different signal molecules, cortisol, which is a stress hormone from the adrenal glands, and aldosterone, which is a mineralocorticoid from the adrenal glands, all of these have basically the same ring structure, but what's different about them is what particular functional group is sticking off of this ring structure. This is why functional groups get their names. They're functional groups because that particular little set of atoms hanging off of the main body of the molecule gives that overall molecule its particular function. And signals work by binding to receptors somewhere. Well, different signals won't bind to the same receptor. They need their own receptors. And therefore they cause potentially opposite effects in different kinds of cells. Oh, we're done with that now.